the American Security Project's podcast on disaster risk management and climate change adaptation. The American Security Project is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy and research organization dedicated to fostering knowledge and understanding of a range of national security issues, promoting debate about the appropriate use of American power, and cultivating strategic responses to 21st century challenges. ASP's special guest today is Mr. Dante Disparte, founder and CEO of the Risk Cooperative. The IPCC defines climate change as a change in the state of the climate that can be identified by changes in the mean or the variability of its properties, and that persists for an extended period, typically decades or longer. The UNISDR defines a hazard as a potential threat to humans and their welfare arising from a physical event, phenomenon, or human activity. Risk is defined as a probability of a hazardous event occurring, multiplied by an event's negative consequences. It is the result of a hazard's characteristics, exposure, and vulnerability. With increasing global surface temperatures, rising sea levels, hot extremes, such as droughts, will become more frequent. Risk of flooding will increase in areas of heavier precipitation. Tropical cyclones, typhoons, and hurricanes will become more intense, with higher wind speeds and heavier precipitation. With about 20% of the Earth's land area and over half of the world's population exposed to at least one natural hazard, climate change and increased demographic, social, and economic exposure to hazards are rendering populations more vulnerable to extensive disasters. Through their impacts on the environment, climate change-induced hazards will adversely affect our water and food resources, industries and societies, and public health. According to Oxfam, from 2009 to 2014, extreme weather events have cost the world $500 billion and thousands of lives. The cost of climate inaction in dollars and lives is continuing to mount. So Dante, what do you define risk management as in the world of climate change, and how can we adapt the existing disaster risk reduction frameworks to climate change hazards?
That's a great question, and it's I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to address this issue. So in thinking about it, it's sort of the frog in the boiling pot is a good metaphor, at least a good starting point for this discussion, which is that when you throw a frog into a boiling pot, the frog is often likely to jump out. When you gradually raise the temperature on the pot, the frog will stay put. And I think we're in that kind of situation. It's more difficult for societies, governments, companies, countries to respond to a gradual change. And in climate change, I think one of the biggest misnomers had been to call it global warming back in the early days of sort of climate science, as opposed to calling it climate extremes. I think anybody from the United States and anywhere around the world looking at some of the impacts that we've faced would say that, you know, the impacts are real. The risks are real, and the way society will have to adapt and to change to this is fairly profound. And I'll give you a couple of examples of the risk management components to it and how to address those, and then secondly, looking at preparedness and what is the best form of preparedness from the ground level up to sort of the governmental level. One example is Hurricane Katrina, which followed the largest reorganization of the federal government, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, a so-called interconnection between the state, local, city, and federal governments to create this very effective response network. And Katrina, unlike other large-scale surprise events or black swans, was an entirely predictable event. The Army Corps of Engineers and many others knew that the levees in New Orleans were a challenge. And nonetheless, the entire apparatus failed post-crisis, post-disaster. And we had a large loss of human life. We had a large, one of the largest cities in America effectively flooded and rendered a no-go zone. And so that wasn't so much a failure of preparedness because the assets were there. The human capital was there. The Army Corps of Engineers, the National Guard, and the entire apparatus was there. It was a failure of action, and it was a failure of the response process. But from a preparedness vantage point, again, all the material was on hand. It just wasn't deployed rapidly. And there's talk of Walmart and other private sector firms having had a faster response because their supply chains were much more agile in the face of this calamity. And looking from Katrina, then, you know, think of a more recent example where large percentages of the East Coast, 2 years in a row, there was one near miss with Hurricane Irene the year before Sandy that was effectively the same type of freak event. It was a large-scale storm that veered north, infected the entire eastern seaboard. And then the year after, you have Sandy. And, you know, the consequences of which were hitherto unthinkable, that a hurricane could conceivably, you know, flood the U.S. Financial capital in New York City the way that it did, really brought to light that the exposures that we're talking about are not isolated events, nor are we going to talk about them in 100 years from today. I think today and right here and now is the time for us to be prepared. Looking at it then in an emerging and a developing world context, the two things come to mind. One, you think of the Indian Ocean tsunami, which affected more than 12 countries, killed hundreds of thousands of people, but the financial impact in the insurance and risk management domain was negligible. It was about around a $20 to $30 billion total claim across property, loss of life, and other insured risks. By contrast, the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear trifecta in Japan cost more than $300 billion in primarily property and primarily the loss of life. But it raises the inequity of how the insurance and financial markets have responded to large-scale risks. Effectively, the advanced economies are you know, 100% insured, overinsured. They have government backstops, and they have a whole host of layers of protection. Whereas the emerging and developing world, you know, insurance penetration in Africa is a mere 2%. And so it raises a number of real questions about the developmental consequences of being underinsured and which societies and which countries are bearing the brunt of extreme climate events. So kind of an opening remark. Looking at it then from the what can you do about it, right? I guess is the first question that would come to mind. I think the one element of this is instead of focusing on predicting the consequences of large-scale events, which is where a lot of countries, governments, think tanks, and so on are putting their resources, I think the entire shift ought to be towards survivorship. How do one survive them? Which types of events are going to have large scale consequences, human displacement, and how do you build resilience in sort of societies, and how do you build resilience in systems so that they can survive them? Because in risk management, there's an adage that you don't fight complexity with complexity. You need to fight complexity with simplicity. And a simpler approach to these types of things, you know, invariably is the right way to go.
So touching on what you just said, based on during Katrina, you said that the private sector had a faster response than the government that had just been recently organized. So in the event of these extreme weather, or even if they're known and unknown extreme weather events, what do you think that the government and the private sector's roles should be? Mm-hmm. And how do you think that they should work together in order to effectively respond to the disasters that we will continue to face?
That's a great question. And so a couple of examples of where, there has to be a collaborative response, right? The boiling pot of water is the analogy, is the proxy for the world, and the frog is all of us on the planet, including the public, private sector, individuals, emerging markets, and developed economies alike. We're all in the same boat. And so we need a broad cross-sector response. I'll give you an example where, if you take flood insurance and you take Tornado Alley in the United States of America, the advent of federal programs, in fact, creates a moral hazard such that more people continue to build brick and stick properties and houses in flood-prone areas and tornado-prone areas, because the federal programs are effectively mispricing the risk for those high-risk areas, putting, ironically, more property and more lives directly in the line of sight of these predictable climate events. These are not large-scale climate events. This is the annual flooding. This is the annual sort of run of tornadoes and hurricanes in Florida and so on. But so no alternatives have emerged in the private sector that, one, adequately price for these types of exposures, and two, create building codes that are much more resilient. And so even in the United States of America, we're not seeing broad-based thinking and broad-based innovation on resilience, partly because the federal programs, the national programs, are mispricing these risks. So that would be a moral hazard, risk-taking, but without bearing the consequences of these risks. And then when you look at it in sort of, again, on a global scale, there's a whole array of spaces where risk management solutions are only nascent, from climate-related issues in agriculture to crop failures and these types of things. There's a whole series of programs that are available, but that where you had a government backstop and a sort of public-private approach to these types of product innovations, you would see much more development in the market and much more sort of sound risk transfer. And the key thing is there's no bad risk, there's only a mispriced risk when it comes to the financial markets. And there's a lot of things that that can be addressed that have a positive developmental impact that create more resilient sort of solutions in the face of climate extremity.
With urbanization and increasing population, and you're finding that you have a much higher populations in areas that are at increased risk of climate change related disaster events, and especially in these emerging economies where you have more of the exposed assets, financial assets, human assets, capital assets, more concentrated in these areas. How do you think that will impact the financial impact of disasters in the future in these developing and emerging economies?
Sure. Well, I think we're in really, truly in unprecedented territory, not only for the climate implications of where we are as a planet and sort of human civilization, but we're also in unprecedented territory in the fact that just over the last decade, more people live in urban environments than in rural environments for the first time in human history. So we've all witnessed the death of Homo sapiens and the rise of this new category, Homo urbanus, you know, an urban-dwelling humanity. And with that comes, you know, the higher concentration of people in urban environments. Think of, think of the Arab Spring, prompted by a whole confluence of events that only an urban melting pot could produce. High youth unemployment, high urbanization, high degrees of interconnectivity with the rest of the planet given the rise of mobile phones. And then you have with it the ability to continue to communicate and fan the so-called embers of this type of unrest. And climate impacts are very much the same. Since the dawn of civilization, man has set foot and built the footholds of their societies along rivers, along deltas, along coastlines. And so that has increased vulnerability. The Indian Ocean tsunami versus the Japanese tsunami, however, raises the issue of the inequity that a lot of these developing societies face. Even though they might have urbanized and even though there's an inexorable rise in their GDP and their production and the level of foreign direct investment that these countries are attracting, there's a huge inequality in how well covered they are. And that raises a big problem. So of all the industries, insurance is one of the most interesting if you're not if you're sort of a social entrepreneur, because when the service is consumed, there's an undeniable good, right? That rebuilding somebody's home, replacing a stolen car, providing a family who lost a loved one with some semblance of financial continuity is all critical. In the emerging and developing market context, there is often no government spending that could pick up the deficit. So Japan, despite this massive $300 billion financial loss, Japan GDP barely registered a loss, partly because of all this deficit and reconstruction spending. The same doesn't hold true in the developing and emerging world. And that just creates this kind of double whammy, to use to use the expression. You're going to get hit twice by the natural calamity, the destruction of property, the destruction, loss of lives, and then at the same time, the reconstruction and the development efforts will take much, much longer because you're being dragged down by the lack of financial resources.
So, what then can the private sector and the governments in these developing economies and these emerging economies do to manage this risk both domestically and internationally?
Great question. So there's an emerging area of finance, which we have seen probably for the last decade or so in very mature insurance markets like the United States, continental Europe, and Japan, where they've gone beyond the traditional insurance mechanisms, beyond the public-private models, and they've actually gone to the capital markets, and they've created solutions such as catastrophe bonds, which are investment vehicles, special purpose vehicles, that allow for a whole series of additional liquidity in the market. Number one, so you know, a traditional insurance company will have a certain amount of tolerance for losses, especially natural catastrophes and sort of weather-related events. Above them, you usually have a reinsurance layer. What catastrophe bonds have done is they've tapped the capital markets and the vast liquidity that the capital markets have as a way of, one, creating risk appetite for certain hitherto uninsurable exposures or underinsured exposures. And at the same time, they then have this potential to, you know, really be a transformative force in the developing and emerging markets. To date, there hasn't really been any application of this model in a substantial way in developing and emerging markets. But much like an insurance policy, a catastrophe bond, you know, is taking an underlying weather-related event, or it could be, you know, a societal event, you know, terrorism catastrophe bond or some form of large-scale events. And what it does is it creates liquidity by making those risks bearable to prospective investors and creating more interest by putting a fixed price on uncertainty. And I think that would be one frontier that you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, you'll see much more development in catastrophe bonds and in some form of financial capital market solution where the public and private sectors are really incenting foreign direct investment, they're incenting the development of insurance markets around the world. Because again, these solutions are a catalyst for change when correctly applied. One of the final elements I would say, you know, we need much more coordination between the private and public sector is around areas of regulation. 50 state insurance regulators in the United States, while on one front they're there for the interest of the consumer and they're there for the interest of the insurance market more generally and good conduct within that market, at the end of the day, these institutions and the 50 state regulators create 50 layers of complexity. Very little coordination across the nation, very little coordination across customers and insured classes. And this notion defies the very essence of proper risk management, which is diversification. The law of large numbers implies that the broader the base of the types of risks I'm absorbing, the better and the lower the net cost to each individual risk that is being borne. And when you have 50 state regulatory regimes to adhere to, let alone a global regime to adhere to, you're creating a huge drag on innovation, a huge drag on efficiency, and it's nearly impossible to operate in a cross-border manner effectively.
Great. So you brought up the notion of resilience and creating resilience within these countries and within the financial sector. How can the private and public sectors work to create resilience?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. So a quick analogy that comes to mind when I think of risk management. So an arrest record is no more a sign of crime fighting than an insured claim is a sign of risk management. The objective of crime fighting is to have zero crime. So therefore, when you arrest a lot of people, the crime fighting system has failed. And the same holds true in an insurance environment where a lot of paid claims is a sign that risk management has failed. And so, you know, another quick analogy is you wouldn't want your aircraft engine manufacturer to have anything less than a zero failure objective in building aircraft engines. And so the same holds true for these large-scale catastrophic losses. We shouldn't assume that they're not going to happen. A lot of research, not only in the climate science space, but in other large-scale, hitherto unpredictable events, what they call black swans, a lot of research has shown that these things are much more common. They're not millennial events any longer. They're actually much more predictable and much more within the standard deviations of a probability distribution. They're more easier to forecast than we had once thought. So the notion of resilience then is to assume that big bad things are going to happen all the time, and and to aim for survivorship as opposed to aiming for financial protection, or worse yet, turning a blind eye to these things, as I think much of the debate around climate change has been denialist, right? You have denialists on one extreme, and then you have folks arguing that it is imminent and the threats are imminent, but no sensible discussion has landed in the middle, which is neither to deny it nor to over-promote it, but to figure out how do we become resilient to it and how do we start to unwind, you know, some of these adverse effects that we're having.
So in these developing countries and emerging economies, the risk of investing is high for investors, and especially so in these developing countries where the risks of climate change-induced hazards is very high. So how can investors secure their investments in these countries to kind of mitigate the risk, but still being able to invest and
Great. No, it's a great question. So there's a lot of vehicles through which, you know, traditional investors can protect the investment, but often the tendency is to err on the side of the equity and protect the equity against political risks and government expropriation and these types of challenges, and how to repatriate foreign earned income back to the headquarters and so on and so forth. Acts of God, as they're referred to, or acts of nature, as they're referred to in sort of a traditional insurance policy, would include floods, you know, earthquakes, fire, windstorm, and a lot of these big natural hazards. And you'd be surprised what percentage of foreign direct investment doesn't really contemplate this type of exposure as the thing that can cause a large-scale loss. Again, just bringing it back to the United States, who would have thought that, you know, updating your homeowner's policy on the East Coast of the United States for earthquakes was a problem? And so that's the issue. When you're you know, traditional loss models, they go back to a 30-year data set, and within that this parametric modeling, if they say, look, in 30 years there hasn't been an earthquake on the East Coast of the United States, therefore we don't have that exposure. The problem is, it's known as model error. You need to go back millennia, potentially, to capture the entire series of events that can occur within the natural spectrum. These are not man-made calamities, which are fairly predictable by contrast. This is a completely different scale, and to you know, the whole risk management and all of the probabilistic sciences don't understand. I think the natural scientists get it because they're looking at a millennial level and they're looking at eons, as opposed to, you know, the insurance and financial markets, where we've been trained to look at 30-year intervals or 10-year intervals for loss information. So you know, the reason weather-related calamities have such a heavy impact in emerging and developing markets isn't because the events are much more likely there. It's because the level of infrastructure and the level of preparedness is lower, right? So a flood in the Niger Delta, a flood in Bangladesh is going to have a vastly larger human cost and a vastly larger property cost than a flood along the Mississippi. One, because of just the development, and secondarily, because of the ability for folks to respond faster. So, you know, protecting, I think looking at an insurance solution, or looking at the capital markets, as I had mentioned before, catastrophe bonds and so on, as a vehicle to cover foreign direct investment from the perils, natural perils and things like that, I think it's a very, very novel concept. And one that is not really mature. I think more and more equity investors are erring on the side of insuring against political risk, which, you know, again, they make for good headlines, but they're not the things that are going to take make investors take a bath, versus looking at the natural hazards as this real major cause of loss. And I think a lot of the emerging and developing markets, that's where the challenge lies. And in interestingly, it's also the feeder for the political risks that they'll then see, you know, from water wars to, you know, the arid lands of the Horn of Africa, triggering all kinds of political consequences to resource conflicts and things like that. You know, these are, I think, the political challenges of the future, to figure out how to keep these two things in balance.
It's interesting that you mentioned the disparity between the natural scientists and the risk managers, because the knowledge, I feel, the geomorphologists and geologists and who are looking at these issues, these natural hazards, have greatly expanded their knowledge on how on forecasting and modeling the long-term disasters, such as earthquakes and looking at the long-term effects of climate change. And I think that it's interesting that we're finding that even with this increased knowledge, that the losses aren't being reduced. And I think that is very much possibly due to the fact that there is that disparity in how they assess the situation of disaster, and how more of it's the geologists and geologists have a longer-term view on these disasters than the people that are financially managing the risk.
Right. Well, and my finance friends would tell me that that's part of the reason the financial system is extremely resilient, especially on the insurance and risk management side. The Sendai earthquake, again, a $300 billion loss, and while absolutely the entire system was distressed, no company to my knowledge, no major company to my knowledge, went under. And so that's part of the challenge. There is also a risk in being overinsured, in that you're going to take risks that you wouldn't have taken otherwise. So to bring it to the financial context, when there's a calamity on Wall Street and there's a financial calamity and the major banks in the United States and around the world go bust, we've privatized gains, but we've socialized losses. And so the act of taking, you know, large financial failures and then spreading the losses across a large public is a lot of what is happening as well with climate-related risk management and climate-related insurance. And that, again, you know, flood insurance, a lot of these programs, what they're doing is they're removing these risks so that the true financial costs are not being borne by the businesses, by the inhabitants, the residents of these regions. Those are being passed on elsewhere, and we're all subsidizing it in some form or another. It's not just magically being paid for without having a subsidy come from somewhere. And so when you remove these types of risks, you then create adverse selection. You create a pattern in which folks will continue to bear these risks because the cost is borne by some other party. And, you know, I think, again, climate-related things, we could only kick the ball down the line so far, and the can, so to speak, you know, down the line so much more before we really start to have to make some large-scale decisions. If you're the mayor of New York or you're a resident of, you know, Manhattan, a $40 billion investment to build, you know, Dutch-style levees around the island of Manhattan, this is a very, very large investment, and the public is going to pay for these investments. It's not going to come from nowhere. Equally, having a privatized financial response to these types of risks means that the cost, I think, will be more transparent and will be borne by firms and organizations and institutions that can sort of think about the return on this investment. While the social costs are fairly clear, I think the only approach is a public-private model, you know, one where there's a lot of accountability and where the costs are spread across the broadest space possible.
So to conclude, what do you foresee as the major challenges to disaster risk management in the wake of climate change and increasing climate change?
Well, I think they're multidimensional. The first element is back to the frog analogies that we're all in this, and there's no doubt that, at least not in my mind, and absolutely, I think the folks in the risk management and the finance world are starting to understand this deeply. That you know, you cannot deny the trend. You cannot deny Katrina, Irene, Sandy, and. You know, increasing seismic activities around the world is completely, it would be completely irresponsible to deny the impact. And with the advent of, you know, urban man and urban woman and urban sort of societies, you know, the consequences, the human consequences are dire. Where I think we head for solutions, because the good news is, you know, I think a lot of the major challenges are reversible, and I think we can build more resilient societies. I think where the financial markets will add a lot of value is in adequately pricing risks, inadequately making it known down to the granular individual actor level that when you build in a floodplain, there are consequences. Therefore, you should not build in a floodplain. And if so, innovate. And when you build in a tornado alley, innovate. And removing the moral hazards that are embedded in the system will allow for financial innovation, will allow for structural innovation and societal innovation such that we become more resilient. But by and large, I think the trend is clear. The types of things that can be done at the sort of macro level and down at the national level to create more resilience is also clear. But as the Katrina example shows, preparedness isn't enough. You also have to be able to act swiftly in the face of these major events and in as aligned and in as broad-based a manner possible to limit the loss of human life and the loss of property value.
Great. Well, Dante, thank you. I think this proved to be an extremely informative and eye-opening discussion on disaster risk management and climate change. Climate change and the increasing severity of natural hazards are clearly pressing global concerns that necessitate attention, especially action and investment. Thank you again, Dante, for your unique insights into these issues. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the American Security Project's Climate Change and Disaster Risk Management podcast. For more information, visit www.americansecurityproject.org.